Kempton Pock. You can interpret it in any way you wish. Alright, Mr. Bassett, you'll introduce your team just for the record.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. On my left, I think you know everybody, but to do the introductions is Ms. Grace Kambula. She's Chief Director of the Chief Director of Vulnerable Groups. And on my right, I'm sure you know Ms. Bronwyn Pithy. She's assisting us from the NPA today. We're pleased to have her here. And then next to her is Ms. Hami Mokhela Lebuku Wilderness. She's also been here before and has spoken to the
committee.
In the corner is Ms. Bambi Lukuru. She's the State Law Advisor dealing with the South African Human Rights Commission Bill, which we'll be dealing with later. And that is our conflict.
Welcome to all of you. Honourable members, yesterday we dealt extensively with the Judicial Matters Bill, and you indicated that this essentially I asked the question, is there any reason why we shouldn't proceed to approve this bill? And your indication yesterday was that there was no reason.
So we said that you need a clean copy of the bill.
Yes.
So we were pretty
sure. Yes. All right. Clean copy of the bill. For what reason? Yes. Good. We have that, Mr. Bassett?
Yes, and there's what they call it, a keen copy with the changes that the committee accepted yesterday, and then there's a list as well.
Yes.
And then there are a few technical amendments that we would have to bring about to the objects memo, because the objects memo must also be considered by the committee. Now there should be three documents that share. Thank you, Jed. I presume we're working full rather than the A-list. The A-list is a technical one.
Yeah.
The First Amendment. This clause 6. Council. Chair, what I've done is the things have changed in the bill. Proposed insertions are double underlined and proposed deletions are in terms of indicated by the strike through. This on will not be underlined in that A list. That mustn't be underlined. And because that is the way it should be in the legislation. So that's just a technical amendment. The next amendment is to clause 8, and that is on page 9. The proposed amendment to section 271DA, sub clause 1A. Also, a suggestion from the Bar Council. The Director General must inform the applicant in writing. Paragraph B. The Director General must afford the applicant an opportunity to furnish compelling reasons to him or her or the Minister within 20 working days after the applicant is informed of the intention to revoke, why his or her record should remain expunged and not be strike through the word B. Paragraph C, the Director General must inform the applicant in writing. That was a similar suggestion. And then the last thing, paragraph D, the Director General must inform the head of Criminal Record Centre of SAT in writing. So those are the amendments there, Chair. Next one, let's just get my bedroom. Next amendment is clause 15. That's on page 15 as well. The insertion into the attorneys at section 46A, giving the Board of Control of the Fidelity Fund the power to institute private prosecution, and the committee agreed that the words "and upon written notice to the society of the province concerned" must be asserted. So we need not understanding the provisions of section 76 Board of Control may by any person authorised there in writing by the chairperson and upon written notice to the society of the province concerned institute private prosecution. On page 16, clause 17 is also an amendment to the Attorney Act. This gives the Board of Control the power to apply to court to have the trust account or to prohibit an attorney from operating his or her trust account. It's a power that the law societies currently have, and the Board of Control of the Fidelity Fund requested this power too. And it was agreed between the profession, those two bodies, and this committee that power must be exercised in consultation with the society of the province concerned.
Okay.
And documented.
Yes?
On page 30.
Yeah.
I think it's above 4. I noticed something that may have been overlooked, where it says a child is referred to in that section 3, maybe sentence to a sentence of imprisonment. Is that the term we normally use when we say to a term of imprisonment? Maybe sentence to a term of imprisonment. Isn't that?
I think that would probably, yes, I think that would probably, I think that's what we generally use, but this is the way it is in the Child Justice Act, and yes, we want to change that now. What say you all?
I was just finding it out, looks like an anomaly.
It is, yeah.
I don't know the implications of that. I don't change right now whether it changes or not.
And the same issue, Mr. Chaffer?
No.
Is the what?
Sub 5 says the same thing. You just looked at it. The Child Justice was imposing a sentence on prison, so they might have it. And if you look at the top of the page as well.
Yeah, it seems to be consistent in Principle Act.
Get it wrong, but
yes.
At the front of the check, I mean, are we taking out T? Is there the possibility of imposing racial supervision on its own, elsewhere? Or are we excluding that possibility completely by moving this? Surely we could have imprisonment or
curriculum. There is, if we go to Rules 41, Child Justice Court that convicts a child of an offence may impose a sentence of correctional supervision.
Okay. Alright. Yeah, otherwise we'd need to go to the Principal Act and change the whole thing there. And that's going to take too much more. Alright.
That clause 44, page 31, it was agreed yesterday that if a person is, if a child is sentenced to any form of imprisonment that was not wholly suspended, it was agreed that those words should come out. Yes, and as not indicated in yours, I changed that earlier this morning, but I have got it in my document.
Well, it's here. It's
been removed. Yeah. Thank you. Then the next amendment is also in clause 44, and that's on the top of page 32. It was agreed that a new paragraph D should be inserted, so it will read, irrespective of the duration of the sentence, and the committee agreed that we put in the period the judicial officer who sentenced the child in question has held the substantive rank of magistrate or legal magistrate, C, whether the child in question was represented by legal representative, or, and what is proposed now, is whether the child in question appeared before district court or regional court is sitting at the Child Justice Court. Then the next set of amendments is in clause 45. Those amendments are very similar or exactly the same as the amendments that we discussed in respect of clause 8. Let me just take you through the Director General, and I'm referring to proposed section 877A. The Director General must inform the applicant in writing. B, the Director General must afford the applicant the opportunity to finish the reasons why his or her record should remain expunged. C, the Director General must inform the applicant in writing, and D, the Director General must inform the head of the Criminal Records Centre of SAPS in writing, as we discussed yesterday. And then what we didn't discuss yesterday, Chair, but we did discuss it when we did the briefing, clause 49,
right.
Official title, and suggested, I don't know how that happened, in the bill that was introduced, it was indicated that clauses 35, 38 and 45 come into operation on a date fixed by the President. The provisions that must be put into operation are in fact clauses 36, 39 and 46. Clauses 10, 10 and 11, as we discussed yesterday, come into operation on the 1st of April 2010, that's the day the Child Justice Act came into operation, and 48 is the intro come into operation on the 20th of September 2010, that's the day that the recognition of as the customary law succession act came into operation. And the only other sections in this bill that require putting into operation, because the regulations are something that are required to be done, are those two clauses, 36, 39 and 46. And there are also some, and the amendments that I've just taken you through are all reflected in the A-list. I have had this endorsed by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor, so and that's been through that process as well. And then the committee should also, I understand, consider the memorandum of the objects. I'm not sure whether that has been made available. If it hasn't, I can take you through this. How was it made available? There are some technical amendments on page 8. Some of the amendments that I've just taken the committee through that aren't reflected in an objects letter because they are technical amendments. Not all what I've just spoken about to actually appear in objects letter. On page 8, right at the top of the page, the proposed new section 46A provides that the Board of Control may, on written notice to the Law Society of the province concerned, institute a final prosecution. And lower down in that, on that page, paragraph 2.8.5, this is the amendment to clause 17. At the request of board, clause 17.6 to amend section 78H of the Act, provide that the fund may also apply for this remedy in consultation with the Law Society of the province concerned. Chair, and then another barrister.
That's all the amendments to the
Mr. Comisa campaign made a suggestion in respect to the preamble, and it's to the following effect: because sexual offences courts begin to play a significant role, it is suggested that they feature in the preamble to the principal act. And the wording is as follows: and whereas it is recognised that designated sexual offences courts will contribute towards combating high levels of sexual violence, especially against women and children, and those experience sexual violence as a consequence of their sexual orientation or gender variance, increase public confidence in the criminal justice system, reduce secondary trauma of victims, increase conviction of perpetrators of sexual offences through efficient and effective prosecution of sexual offences, and support a victim in a victim-friendly, well-resourced and prioritised manner. So we in the department raise the question whether it's appropriate. I think what this commentator is saying is important, and introduction of sexual offences is a big issue and is important. It is, however, a technical aspect, and the question is raised whether it should appear in a preamble. Preambles usually set up broad issues setting the scene, as it were, for the enactment of the proposed legislation, and the preamble to this legislation does do that. We do raise the question whether it might not be more appropriate to insert something about these courts in the long title, the Principal Act. I've suggested some wording there. The long title to the Sexual Offences Act, let me just read the introduction, goes like this: to comprehensively and extensively review and amend all aspects of the laws and the implementation of the laws relating to sexual offences, and to deal with all legal aspects of or relating to sexual offences in a single statute by, and then there are a whole list of bullets. So if the committee wants to put something in along these lines, it would be by designating specific courts where necessary to deal with matters relating to sexual offences or something similar.
Mm-hmm. payphones, smarts, anybody else?
I think we need to flag this because there are some other permissions that may interest, you know, are we going to go for the specific course or not? And I know there are magistrates who have concerns about being exclusively sexual. So I think maybe we just flag it for now until we finalize what exactly we need to say these courts are actually to entice. I know they also want to broaden it to other, to check whether it incorporates all kinds of sexual offences and other legislation as well. I don't know if that'll make any difference, but maybe, I don't know if we should start it right now. But I think in principle it's generally a good idea to add it there, not in the preamble.
Actually, I agree. I think that the department's response here, I think this is too long, the preamble, and we need to look at just that short sentence, inserting that where it's appropriate in the long title. So, that really might take the seat if you start coming. We are more inclined to agree with the department's response.
This is all awesome.
Yes, I also want to agree with the formulation by the department, but you need to cover a couple of points. They are content with in that long subject. But I just wanted to find out, maybe the colleagues, whether the correct term would be specific or certain court by designation. Certain court or specific court.
Yes.
Well, you said would be the term.
Yes.
That deals with your concerns.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? No. All right, Mr.
President. The next one is going to the House of Law. It's supposed to call it Section 55A because it's not a clause.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a proposal by, I don't know if it's Mr. or Ms. Harimser, Mr. Harimser, Acting Regional Magistrate in Cape Town. He suggests that Section 55A of the Act seeks to empower the Minister designate quarter sexual offences, but is silent on what will be deemed as being a sexual offence. And he recommends that the court should define this and amend the definition section of the Act to include a definition of sexual offences. Court may be defined as a court designated by the Minister, which is dedicated for the purpose of the trial of any person or persons who have criminal proceedings arising out of the election. Of sexual offences or any other offences created under this Act or any other Act. The Department's response is the Act itself does not contain any definition relating to courts. The term sexual offences court is only used once in the book, in the Act, if this book gets incorporated into the Act, and that's only in Section 55A1. And the question has been raised whether it's necessary or indeed appropriate to define it when it's only used once. And the wording that is being suggested for the definition is exactly the same as the wording that's in Section 55A1.
Definition of a sexual offence is quite as authorized, because a sexual offence is court would be that court that is designated by the minister. Mm-hmm. And also, as the minister has correctly said, this word is just only once. So the no need in my view for the deputy.
Mr.
Sherman.
There's one concern, that's what I was kind of reading to. I've been approached by magistrate in one of the smaller provinces, who is concerned that if we're going to designate third courts specifically for sexual events, first of all, you know, you might only have one court per province, which is going to be very difficult for people to get to, accused and witnesses and so on. And the other thing she said is that about something like 60% of cases at the moment are already sexual offences in any case. So I just want us to be careful that once we allow for specific courts to be designated, that we don't exclude other courts that aren't very specifically designated from dealing with sexual offences by how we were thinking that. And in this case, particularly regarding the definition, there may be other courts that are not specifically designated that might be covered by what is going in this clause here, and I think we just be careful we don't exclude that possibility by only limiting the provisions to those specific courts.
Okay.
check if the minister made a late call as such an officer, and they are not already operating as such. I don't think any minister would want to interfere with this because they've already been fulfilling that. So I think that the fear may not be there.
No, I mean, I just don't want, you know, we might be confining this wording only to those specific courts that the minister is going to do. So I agree, I don't think he would want to change it, but I think in reality there may be other courts that are operating also doing sexual offences cases that may not be one of those specifically designated by the minister. So I don't want to exclude that by limiting this kind of definition to that court only.
Well, thank you, Mr. Benson.
I'm wondering whether Sackville's fire doesn't take care of that substitute. Section does not refer to the court referred to in subsection 1 or dealing with matters referred to in that subsection. It is not in that
subsection.
I just wanted to say that I think the work of the court is not considered that it has to be accommodated in some way, but it's not really accommodated in some way.
So, Magistrate Harris's recommendation is not for you to.
So, also, would you like to say these courts should not be dedicated to deal with official offences only, but should also be empowered to deal with more serious offences involving local charges. For example, trafficking of persons. And the portfolio committee should consider the following imagination for why he's saying this. Human trafficking has been recognized as the third largest criminal industry in the world. The UN estimates that trafficking of persons generates $7 billion dollars annually for traffickers. The remaining sexual offenses, which are not only equipped with close circuit audio visual equipment, but most of the judicial officers and prosecutors dedicated to courts are best suited to deal with young child witnesses. And then he goes on to recommend revising section 55A, which is exactly the same as in the bill. The minister may designate certain courts as sexual offences courts for the purposes of requiring a person or proceedings arising out of the commission of a sexual offence in terms of the common law, any offence in terms of the Sexual Offences Act, or any offence in terms of this Act, and then he proposes the addition or any offence in terms of the Children's Act.
Why the Children's
Act? I'm not sure why he's doing that.
But assumes he hasn't been out of trafficking.
But I have a feeling that it's other offences as well against children. Our response to that, Chair, would be to give the courts jurisdiction to deal with serious offences involving young child victims would be inappropriate. Principal Act, Sexual Offences Act, deals with sexual offences exclusively where victims are children, adults and persons who are mentally disabled. To give effect to this proposal would be expanding the ambit of the Principal Act. If a court is to deal with all serious offences against children, it should then be legislated elsewhere, not in the Sexual Offences Act. Although other commentators expressed similar sentiments in this regard, it should be borne in mind that one of the primary purposes of sexual offences courts is to protect vulnerable witnesses, which in turn lead to more successful prosecutions. While there might be other legislation which creates offences, the elements of which may be of a sexual nature, for instance, trafficking in persons for sexual purposes, as set out in the trafficking legislation, and child pornography as set out in the Forms and Publication Act, the focus of that legislation is not on sexual offences per se. For instance, in the Forms and Publication Act, the display and provision of child pornography is a criminal offence. Possession and displaying it. In addition, the Sexual Offences Act contains detailed provisions related to the use of children and disabled persons for purposes of pornography. So, these are two examples that have been mentioned by a few commentators. Why shouldn't sexual offences courts also be used for offences created under the trafficking legislation and child pornography legislation? I'm trying to respond particularly to consideration could be given to what the NPA is suggesting, rather than to say any offence in terms of the Children's Act is to say any related offence in relevant legislation that deals with sexual offences. That is a possibility that we can look at, so we wouldn't want to restrict it to the Children's Act, but there could be a possibility of saying any offence of a sexual nature created in other legislation. And the question arises, I wonder if anything like that. The only examples I can think of is trafficking and pornography.
I quite like the idea of expanding if we can, but not just to children, to any sexual kind of crimes related with vulnerable groupings. But I think we need to maybe a bit more checking as to what might be included in that. I mean, could we use the trafficking, the sexual trafficking there?
Nothing to include.
Yeah, I think that's quite a wise idea, because the purpose of the court is to ensure that those vulnerable people are officially treated. So if we've got the facilities there and the people there to do that, then I think it makes sense.
As soon as we put into the law. Smart and the
document. Just that last comment, I think it's really interesting. But as it's presently worded, trafficking does not work unless you charge the alternative with an offence and sexual offence.
Yes.
And now it would be an astronaut putting it in. Specifically. Whether we want to or not. I like the idea. I like the idea, but what are the consequences?
That's what's worrying me.
Thank you. Our concern of listing specific pieces of legislation, say like the Trafficking or Film Publications Act, is that unless we do a whole lot of research, make sure there aren't other pieces of legislation that might fall or that might contain sexual offence. And that may, you know, the Children's Act immediately comes to mind that there are some aspects there. We're very clear and we're important to the department that it should not go any further than sexual offences. I think we must exclude it for limited that. But that, say for example, in a child pornography case, even if you're charging under the Forms and Publications Act, you may very well want to use a victim that is involved in the manufacturer who would be a child, and to exclude that would be problematic. So we either make it broad enough to say any other relevant piece of legislation that formulation that
Well,
it would be, in terms of the charges that would be placed before the accused, it would be the NPA bringing those charges.
Okay.
Just make it broader, but maybe not limit ourselves to this specific legislation.
But then you may leave something else and then there will be challenge. So sorry, Dr. Mitchell.
I was actually attracted to the idea of further research. Because in Norway, to say there is something called sexual trafficking is to combine sexual offences and human trafficking. And for me, the two should be treated as separate offences. By trafficking human beings, that's actually very still a crime against humanity. Or on it. But now, if someone commits a sexual offense, that's a sexual offense. But if this business of capturing people, taking them to places for the purpose of sex, that's not serious. Like capturing people from Africa to America to make them slaves in a sugar plantation. So you can't equate trafficking in human beings with sexual.
So let me understand you then. You will compose the charges, and then obviously they will say to the court, we like this matter to be done in that way. Because you will have the facts and the evidence before you, including the statements and so on, knowing who's going to appear. And you decide then that yes, it should go to the sexual offences court. However, the charges will include pornography or trafficking.
I think the criteria would have to be that if there is a sexual nature to the event, so that it would be trafficking. If it were only trafficking without any sexual aspect to it, then we wouldn't put it in the criminal sexual offence. But say there were 20 charges of trafficking, only one of which related to sexual offences, then we would place it in the sexual offences court because we would want to protect victims. I guess some could argue that even when our victims that were testifying, which would be highly unlikely, but maybe in a situation of promise and obligation, that there would be no need to put it into the sexual offences court if we didn't have victims or complainants who were testifying. Because the reason we had the court is to protect victims. So if there aren't victims that we're using, because say it's possession of pornography where we actually don't even identify a victim, then there wouldn't be any point. But maybe that would be at the discretion of the NPO or the court that is here.
Yeah. There's also this phenomenon of sex slaves. You know, when you deal with sex slaves, it's not just like a sex shop. We're fully deprived a human being of their freedom in this whole world. And when such people are caught, simply confine the problem to those who had sex with them, or those who made them available for using for sex. I think we're putting too much in one definition. I don't know, but I'm just thinking that maybe we do need to think more of this issue of not rushing.
Mr. Swanson, then Mr. Schiff.
In such a case, you would charge with sexual offence plus kidnapping plus abduction in that sexual offence that is at court. So you would add all those other charges, which is the stuff it covers, not only that you, but the essence, you would need to find a sexual offence like a trafficking, for example, for the labour purposes, where you people are trafficked to work on farms or whatever. That won't fall under these courts. And I understand the purpose is on protecting vulnerable victims.
The right idea of leaving the NPS sufficient flexibility for them to decide, rather than for us to be hard and fast to put it here, because that in itself creates enormous problems. Sorry, Mr. Schiff.
No, I mean, it's not like these people are going to be some second-rate courts. They're going to be specialized courts to protect the victims of exactly that kind of behavior. So I don't think, you know, it's actually a benefit for people. You get, and the magistrates are trained to deal with all offences. They just have specific training for sexual acts. So it's not like they're not going to be convicted of trafficking or anything like that. So I think if you look at it, it's not minimising the seriousness of trafficking at all. It's quite contrary.
Okay.
And that broad agreement that it's the general thoughts.
Thank you, Chair. Let me go that takes care of Magistrate Harris's proposals. Let me go on to the NPA's proposals. In respect to Section 55.1, the NPA is saying the impression is that the Minister can designate any division of the High Court as a dedicated court, which might be interpreted to be that all High Courts in that particular division will be designated as sexual offences courts. And it's recommended the intention is to provide the Minister with authority to designate a High Court or courts or any specific court within a division to be a dedicated sexual offences court. We agree, Chair, and it might be appropriate to use wording along the following line. The Minister may, by notice and neglect, designate any division of the High Court or the main seat or any local seat of a division. Because in this area of courts act, you have main seats and local seats.
Any comments? Everyone? Rain, nodding heads? Good.
Great, Tim.
Right. That formulation, Bruno? Okay? Yes. Right, Ms. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. Paragraph B of the NPA's submission, the question was raised by the NPA whether our reference, whether the reference to magistrates caught in the proposed poll as defined in Section 1 of the Superior Courts Court, which is my act, is correct. Let me just read it. The section says, subject to subsection 2, the Minister may by notice in the Gazette designate a division of the High Court or Magistrates Court as defined in Section 1 of the Superior Courts Act. And the question was raised whether that would be correct. Bronwyn has helped me out, and I think our proposed wording is in fact correct, because if you have a look Superior Courts Act, a magistrate's court is defined as means any person, any court established in terms of Section 2 of the Magistrates Court. And Section 2 of the Magistrates Court allows a minister to establish district and regional courts. I don't think there's anything wrong with our reference to the definition of Magistrates Court in the Superior Courts Act. I'm not going to read the whole section. Then go on to paragraph C, which I think is on page 6 of your document. Certainly, NPA agrees with the use of the term dedicated, but in order to avoid conflicting interpretation, the term needs to be defined. And then there's a referred to the what dedicated means in the dictionary. Yeah, I've been advised when we did this call, we didn't have the benefit of the report, not the report, on sexual offences, and it's been suggested that the term dedicated be avoided because the use of the term specialist sexual offences court and dedicated sexual offences courts should possibly not be used in view of international inconsistencies in the international understanding and use of the word specialised. It's therefore recommended that the term sexual offences court be consistently utilised when reference is made to sexual offences courtroom and its accompanying facilities. Maybe I can ask my colleague, Ms. Kambula, to come in here. We suggest that we don't use the word dedicated and that it be amended to read subject to subsection 2 of the minutes made by notice in the Gazette designate any division or seat of a division or magistrate's court as a sexual offences court exclusively for the purposes of the trial of any person or other proceedings arising out of an alleged commission of a sexual offence in terms of the Common Law, Sexual Offences Act of 1957 or any offence in terms of this Act or any offence of a sexual matter in other legislation where it is thought to be formulated.
Okay, thank you. So if I maybe could just add before there's any debate about the NPA position on this. First of all, NPA was part of the MAPSA team, and in principle we absolutely agree that there shouldn't be the use of the word dedicated because that has caused much confusion in the past. Then what happened when we received this bill, what we agree with is that in principle these courts must be dedicated in the sense that of the understanding of the word in the dictionary. In other words, exclude for the exclusive use of. So we're very happy to get rid of the word dedicated because of the confusion that it's created. Just as long as there's an understanding, which has now been drafted, or the proposal of the doc for the exclusive use.
Yes.
So maybe, I don't know what officially does, but that we withdraw that part of the solution, but that we agree that with the new formulation. So there's no debate from our point of view about that.
I was just wondering why even the debate arose in the first place. Because once you say the minister designates the court for something, you are not creating a court. There was not a dedication. So I want to agree with the message.
Anybody else? No? Okay.
On page 8 then of the document is the relation of the NPA in related defence in relevant legislation we already canvassed that. Can we go on to Shukumisa campaign in respect to section 55A1? Proposed insertion of Part 1A essentially addresses the substantive function of sexual offences courts. Designated sexual offences courts because of specialised in and here sexual offence matters are prioritised basis. Sexual offence courts should only be permitted to hear other matters when there is no sexual offence matter in the law. This will prevent wasted resources when designated and fully resourced sexual offence court finds itself in an area where there are geographically few sexual offences matters at court or where for a specific area there is a decline in sexual offence matters. Our promise is that we should see say ordinary criminal courts should only be permitted to hear sexual offences matter where the offence occurs in a geographical jurisdiction where there is no designated sexual offence court. This would be to compensate for the reach of designated sexual offences courts, for example, in remote rural areas that experience very few sexual offence cases. My response is that this is already being taken care of in the proposed clause 5, which allows other courts to deal with sexual offences in areas of this nature.
There again, I can say something. I mean, you're saying only if there has been a specific one designated. What happens if there has been a specific one designated, but it's easier for the witnesses and for the companions to actually go to a closer one where they live? Because what I've heard is that the rural areas actually experience quite a high rate of sexual offences, not a low rate. Should we not be providing for that option if it's easier for the NPA? The NPA can then also make that decision in consultation with the witnesses and the companions, whether they wish to go to another court close by, if they can make the order arrangement.
Yeah, I think the difficulty now is that we're moving into kind of practical implications, and I have no problem with that, because that's the reality of how that's worked. First of all, as you well know, a regional court has regional jurisdiction. So, I mean, if the court is designated for argument's sake in George, the immediate jurisdiction is the George area, but it's actually theoretically, in any case, then problems could be heard in George. But, you know, if we're doing things for the purposes of victims, the idea, as far as I understand from the department, and that's left to be comments on the department, that even if a court is designated as a sexual offences court and has all of the facilities, other regional courts, or courts that sit as regional courts, the objective is to have facilities as well. So even though it may not be designated as a sexual offences court, where the matter is heard should have the basic facilities. And we can't expect victims to travel very far distances simply because, and I use the word simply very broadly, there is a sexual offences court in that province. So I think if we're trying to plan or achieve the objectives of the current act and the proposed bill, that those practicalities would have to be done in the best interest of victims.
Very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Campaign is also saying that there should be an obligation on the minister to consult with civil society in the designation process. So I don't know, there were some members that are here now that were also in the committee when the sexual offences legislation was being considered, and a similar proposal was made. The committee was then of the view, and I'm not sure what it would be now, that it is not necessary to write this approach at all. Meaningful consultation with stakeholders is a pre-gone conclusion. Our courts, including the Constitutional Court, have made this quite clear on numerous occasions. I don't think it would be appropriate for the legislation to say that the minister must consult with civil society, because civil society, NGOs change over years and come and go. I think it's best left unlegislated. Paragraph D. I think this is also what we've already discussed. Sexual Offences Act are not the only legislation that create sexual offences. Consideration should be given to broadening, which we've already spoken about. Proposals have been made by Mr. Campaign, but we've already discussed those. They do go on to say that subclause 5, this clause does not preclude any court referred to in subsection 1 from dealing with matters referred to. They are making proposals regarding subclause 5, and they argue as follows. The subclause does not preclude any court referred to. Sorry. orders, this section does not preclude any court referred to in subsection 1 from dealing with the matters referred to in that subsection if it has not been designated as a sexual offences court. And then they're proposing to add, unless the offence occurs in a jurisdiction where there is a designated sexual offences court, and then such designated sexual offences court must hear the offence on a prioritised basis.
As far as I understand the proposal again, it's a practical implementation. If I may just give an example, what does happen sometimes is, okay, there are two different scenarios. First of all, there's the scenario of when you have a sexual offence and there is no sexual offence court, can the matter be heard in a non-sexual offence court, which you've agreed to. The other scenario is where you have a sexual offence in the jurisdiction of a sexual offence court. Does that matter be heard in the sexual offences court, or can it be heard in another regional court? So, for example, if you have in Belleville, for example, there are six regional courts, one of which is a sexual offences court. Now, if the sexual offences matter happens in that jurisdiction, must that matter be heard in the sexual offences court, or can it be heard in another regional court? For whatever reason, whether it's about a full court role or whether there are other resources available. I think what you're going to be saying is that if the sexual offences matter occurs within the jurisdiction of the designated sexual offences, that matter must be heard in that sexual offences.
Mm-hmm.
So I think practically it has to be very difficult. I think what they're trying to avoid is situations where matters that are important, or not important, I can't say, sexual offences matters, fall into, it's a matter of, I tell you what happens practically sometimes, is that when you have a football club where there are children involved, and very often the matters that involve adults that get bumped into regional courts that are not sexual offences, I think that's what they're trying to avoid. So when you talk about important, not important, I think that, you know, the prioritisation sometimes happens in children.
Thank you, Chair. But then even in that situation, the matching report has recommended that either the non-sexual offences court must have certain facilities that comply with the minimum standards of the sexual offences court. So those will be accommodated in those courts. That is, a non-sexual offences court will have an intermediary, will have a CCTV, will have a witness, a private witness, so those are the minimum requirements.
I mean, I have my reservations about whether those requirements are going to be fulfilled anyway with the budget that's been allocated to it. But the point of the matter is, I don't think we should be limiting the NPS discretion to take another course if it's appropriate. Now, maybe we should pay a suitable course, and then we can, you know, it's up to them what suitable is. They know what suitable is to them, protect the victim. But I mean, if you've got a regional court that's got, you know, very few matters on a roll, and another regional court where they're doing and they can hear it quicker, then that should be done. I mean, it just makes no sense.
It complies with the principle of the speedy trial.
Yeah,
of course, as you said, they have the discretion, and they must give them to them. Sorry, the petition.
Why not send the discretion to another court? Because if you say suitable, then you enter into another court.
But is it suitable or not?
Yeah.
Okay. I like you more to the discretion.
Yeah.
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 And you might get people saying it's suitable.
Well, okay, then they must argue that point. Okay. All right,
Mr. Chairman, last issue for me, Mr. Campbell, is using the addition of a subclause 6, new subclause 6 to the following effect, where a sexual offence has allegedly been committed by a child, the matter must be heard in accordance with the Child Justice Act. I don't think we need to say that that will be regulated by the Child Justice Act. Chair, then we go on to the NPAs. Comments in respect of section 5A2, they submitted the comments before the Superior Court Public Payment Act, so paragraph A is fine, it's gentlemen. They are suggesting that the words in consultation used in section 55A2 should rather be after consultation, so it would linguistic consensus, but there might be another reason why after consultation would be appropriate.
There's an agreement that there needs to be consultation at the meeting. I think what we were thinking is that surely at the end of the day, the minister has the final say. And what we were concerned about was that it's just maybe it's semantic, maybe it's an understanding in terms of statutory interpretation. In consultation, sounds to us like the minister at the end of the day cannot make the ultimate decision. And after consultation means that at the end of the day the minister makes the decision.
Regardless of
whether there are objections. And the NPA position was that at the end of the day the minister must have the final say. Things that is the minister's piece of legislation.
Having said that, what if the minister decides to do it and it's completely and utterly impossible for the NPA to provide two dedicated prosecutors at court? I mean, this is not going to work. Mm-hmm. And if he says that, well, you cut my budget, then now what?
I guess my question is, how is this done in other pieces of legislation and what kind of consultation is necessary? What kind of consultation or level of consultation and decision making exists? I mean, it really was maybe more a question than anything. Because my concern is as well that if there are other departments or other departments that say we simply can't do this, then we're going to get completely short. And the current act basically says that the minister consults with other departments and then the regulations are made and the national instructions and the directives are passed. And it actually goes to principle the discussions later around the regulation as to what level of authority the minister has vis-a-vis the other ministers around the regulation and around the directive of national instructions, etc. So,
did you want to come in?
No, I've noticed. I'm just worried that if the law has given the authority, the minister must implement it. Now, if you create another process of consultation to people that may not even be available when they need to, wouldn't it be fair to say, obviously, when the minister implements, he will take into account
not necessary to describe it as a consultation. You take into account if where things are not workable, of course you will not proceed, but you won't be workable. That is too complicated.
Well, I'm thinking that the issue is pedantic, whether it's consultation or after consultation, because the regulations will stipulate steps that the minister will take into consideration in order for him to submit. And we, I think in the spirit of the Act, they will include consultation as the Act really prescribes interdepartmental implementation. So I agree that whether it's in or after, it's in order.
I'll try really hard not to say what I want to say in that, but because if you understand the basic difference in all three in and after consultation, it's quite a fundamental distinction. What I was going to say is argue against my earlier again in a sense, because I think also the NBA could use this as well if they want to stall designated to the courts, which I don't think they will maybe push into them, but you know, there could be a department or official or somebody who wants to stonewall minister dedicating this particular court, though maybe it is better after, but there might be consultation with
well after takes care of.
Exactly.
After consultation.
Now he's responding to Dr. Sheffield.
Even if the minister simply picks up the phone and speaks to whoever, that constitutes consultation and he's fulfilled the requirements of the law. We don't want a situation which is provided in consultation where any of the parties affected can say, no, I don't agree, then it comes to mind in court.
So that was a situation where he picks up the phone and he's unconsulted when he's been told on the phone when he's been consulted that it's physically impossible to have the litigate.
But
that's not
what
No, it's not what I think. Dr. Mitchell.
Also, I think you see, our temporary position is good.
Mm.
Because since some cases can be, it may not even be necessary to consult because it's not true. So at least, that's to say, after consultation, the combined cases in the back of our minds, we know that it will happen if it's
necessary. Chair, I just had a look at that run and prompted me that the regulations, other regulations that are made in terms of this fact, but are after consultation, so there we go.
Yeah. All right. Sorry, Prof. Prof. Lavello.
And the beauty of after consultation is that it brings in objectivity.
Then we go to Shukamisa Tempen, as I referred to the status of the Superior Court's bill that Vanessa had promised. We go back to Magistrate Hollinger. He's saying, notwithstanding the fact that the bill, section 55A2, confers the authority on the Minister to determine territorial jurisdiction of the Sexual Offences Courts. Such authority will, however, be ancillary to provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act as it relates to jurisdiction. Section 110 of the Criminal Procedure Act, for example, provides that a court would be deemed to have jurisdiction where the accused fails to raise the defense of lack of territorial jurisdiction in terms of Section 106 of the Criminal Procedure Act. And he says there are similar provisions, for instance, Section 22.3 of the NPA Act, and Section 90 of the Magistrates Court Act. In a nutshell, he's saying we should take into consideration these other provisions on the statute book, which also have a bearing on jurisdiction. We tend to agree with him and suggest that subsection 3 could read like this, subsection 4, or any other law regulating the jurisdiction of the court, the area of jurisdiction of the court designated in terms of subsection 1 is the area of jurisdiction determined in terms of section 2 of the Magistrate Court Act. And so it goes on, but just to take cognizance of the existence of other provisions.
Are you okay with that, Honourable Members? Okay. Anybody else?
Okay. Yeah, and in this document I just set out what those other provisions are, so I'm not
easy
to do that. I'll speak to that.
Thank you.
I think then we can go on to page 16, the MPA in respect of clause 55A4. That's again in after consultation. I think that's already been sorted out. So, this decision is after. MPA agrees with section 55A5, and it does refer to section 67. Should the MISA campaign in respect of proposed section 67, which is regulations provision, to the MISA campaign is saying that the proposed substitution of section 67 of the Sexual Offences Act essentially governs the future infrastructure of sexual offences courts. The regulations made by the Minister in this regard should put in place all the necessary physical infrastructure, human resources and staff complement, training, management, monitoring and all other detail that will ensure the success of the sexual offences courts. Goes on to say that we must oblige the Minister to make regulations regarding the infrastructure and operationalisation of these courts. The bill must provide guidance regarding the range of details of regulations that are to be made. The Minister must make regulations that give effect to a court model that is based on certain minimum standards, and the regulations that are ultimately made in consultation with all relevant cabinet members and civil society will regulate the physical manifestation of this basic court model by specifying infrastructural and operational requirements that meet the court model standards. I think they might have a point on empowering provision to make regulations should provide some guidance in certain respects. Our response is, for purposes of the proposed new section 55 consideration, we functioning thereof. That's what the provision says now, including requirements for the efficient and effective functioning thereof. It might be useful to expand on what is meant by the efficient and effective functioning thereof. And there's some wording that we are putting forward for consideration by the committee. The minister may, in consultation with Chief Justice, make regulations to give effect to the designation of the court's purview in section 55.1, including the requirements for the efficient and effective functioning thereof, and then possibly to include something along the lines of, with particular reference among others, to 1, infrastructure equipment, 2, sufficient and appropriately trained judicial officers, prosecutors and other court personnel, and 3, support services for victims of sexual offences and the persons referred to in subparagraph 2, those are your court officials, just before that committee's consideration.
I just want to make an observation.
Yes.
Something that we don't have to make, we are a broken nation and a broken state. And we set ourselves up for challenge and lessons. The first one. Why should the experts make their rules in consultation with the judges? Assuming that the judges are only appointed lawyers, don't understand the constitution, and they don't make the rules that are consistent with the constitution. And after all, they make the rules that are inconsistent with the constitution. The court has not lost its jurisdiction. As the validity of those rules. Because you see, for instance, you see today's situation where you have to go to court to ask the court whether the rules are consistent with the Constitution. Similarly, if the minister makes the rules which are consistent with the Constitution, someone can go to court and say, no, these rules are not consistent. But then the minister to say, before you even make the rules for implementation, go on to apply. I think it's taking the Constitution. That's definitely. And secondly, if you say the minister must be obliged to make provision for effective and efficient implementation with regard to the infrastructure, the training of the staff, and so on. We may have a situation where it's not possible to establish and run a court because some respect organization can come and say the court doesn't meet the standard. And then you find that the court doesn't have resources to make sure that those requirements are met. I also think that people think that customary courts are also courts. Now, if a traditional community comes and say, no, I'm being tried here under the tree, there is no electricity, I think we may end up complicating things and setting up our laws and structures as if we are in London and we will set ourselves up for failure. I don't know about that. Maybe we just want to make our law to meet intelligence and matter, but our situation, material conditions,
so the whole point of this bill is to deal with sexual offences. You can't deal with sexual offences under a tree. That's for other courts. That's for the traditional courts which shouldn't be dealing with criminal issues. So this has to comply with certain standards. That's the whole point of this whole, what you call it, that funny word, master of rules. That's the whole point of having the sexual offences court to comply with certain standards, one of which is CCTV cameras, one of which is that people don't have to go and face their victims in this court. Now, if you're going to go and try sexual offences victims under a tree, you're not going to have that. So, whilst I appreciate Dr. Machin's concerns in a general nature, I don't think they should be taken into account for sexual offences court.
Chairman, just to get back to the wording and the the department would have to respond to this, and we didn't put this in our submission. What I am a little confused about is why the consultation with the Chief Justice has to happen in the first place. And maybe there could be some background as to where that actually comes from. Because maybe the suggestion could be then that to just use Section 767 and leave the out, but take this, the part of the including the requirements for the efficient and effective functioning thereof,
mm-hmm.
and put that into under sub A and make it another Roman numeral 4. I mean, obviously with the appropriate language, however one would formulate it. Because that then would take into account that the including requirements efficient and other relates to the other departments and the Department of Justice, as opposed to in consultation with Chief Justice, and that I think may take into consideration your concerns about between the executive and the judiciary. And then the second part of the debate is whether one goes into the details of what that may look like in terms of the infrastructure and the sufficient human resources, etc. But I think maybe the first part of the debate is really bind the consultation, and then the second part is how much detail we should put into it.
All right. Let's do that. I think I like more really proposing. Yeah. Okay. Shift it around. And sounds like that's Christine?
No, I'll do it now.
Okay.
When I see the proposal, I've got some concerns.
Yes. Okay, we will draft something on those lines. And continue. Yes, please. And are we going to discuss the detail of the second link of the proposal, the detail related to with that, are we accepting it? Sub-paragraph relating to infrastructure.
It'll stay there, and what she's proposing is that the word including the requirements for the efficient and effective functioning thereof could end as a Roman form.
Thank you, sir. Then we've finished with Mr. Campaign's proposal, or is that concerned? And then we go to general submissions and recommendations. Magistrate Adam, sir, says the major challenge to the space and the success of these courts is availability of funds. I think we all realise that. He also says that regulatory measures need to be implemented in order to facilitate the efficiency and effectiveness of these courts. Talking about what they require, their minimum requirements, these may include provisions for the appointment of at least 2 intermediaries at each of the designated seats. Complaints in sexual offences cases deserve and need close attention for police and prosecution. Efficiency and effectiveness are often adversely affected by insensitive police officers to which offences are ordered to lack a properly graded police officers and effective investigative techniques. We've discussed those, what is required for, ideally required for a sexual offences course. NPA supports the reintroduction of sexual offences by way of a legislative framework and welcomes the authority assigned to the Minister to designate these courts. Shukamisa campaign supports the initiative and the decision to establish these courts. The bill fails to provide for basic features of sexual offences courts. Such basic features must appear in primary legislation, the infrastructure, human resources and staff complement training, management, monitoring, all other detail that will ensure the success of the courts is not addressed in primary legislation, they say that's what it should be. The basic features, functions and powers of a special court must be determined through primary legislation, not secondary legislation, but regulations, and they argue that it's important to engage civil society in establishment of these courts. Civil society has substantial and practical expertise in implementing support programs relating to sexual offences. They also go on to say that resources are needed in order to introduce these courts.
when the spelling will be applied. Poor quality prosecutions pose a risk to efforts to improve the prosecution of sexual offences. The lack of capacity, skills and knowledge to staff in these courts results in repeated failures of justice. The board must elaborate on what constitutes sexual offences, also then they make concrete proposals in terms of subclause 6, and also talk of saying a designated court must appoint court officials and staff, including presiding officers, prosecutors, intermediaries, court preparation officers and court interpreters, according to the selection criteria and processes as prescribed. Ensure training of all staff listed in paragraph A in the manner prescribed. Ensure that the management of the court is provided in the manner prescribed. And ensure a minimum of 2 prosecutors appointed to the court. And ensure the provision of court preparation services in the prescribed manner. We had a debate when we discussed the proposed wording of this section. Shukamisa campaign also goes on to say that there are other government departments that play a crucial role in service delivery to victims of sexual offences. These include safety and security, correctional services, social development, health and the NPA. They argue that the operation of these courts will necessarily have implications for each of these role players. Given that the primary legislation is silent on the obligations of these departments in relation to the sexual offences, also given further that regulations made by one department, in this case the Justice Department, are not necessarily binding on other departments, they submit that it's crucial for the primary legislation to empower each government role player to be able to make the necessary regulations and issue the necessary directives and instructions for their own officials as they require for the successful operation of these courts. And then they come up with more concrete proposals in terms of legislative provisions. Our argument is that, or our response to that is that the proposed amendment section 67 requires the minister to make the regulations under discussion after consultation with the Minister of the Police, Correctional Services, Social Development and Health and the MEPP. And we don't understand their argument that regulations are only binding on the department that whose minister made them. Regulations that are laid on are binding on everyone, and we're not quite sure what they mean by that. They are requesting that Section 66 be amended. Section 66 deals with directives and national instructions that various functionaries can be made. And they're requesting that the National Commissioner of SAPS, the Director General of Health, and the NPA must all make specific national instructions or directives relating to all duties and procedures in relation to sexual offences courts. And my response is that if you have a look at the existing provisions in Section 66, this is not really necessary because Section 66 already provides that the National Commissioner, for instance, must in consultation with relevant functionaries issue national instructions regarding, and I'm going to quote, all matters which are reasonably necessary or expedient to be provided for, which must be followed by all police officials who are tasked with matters arising out of this legislation. So the wording there is already in Section 66 for these functionaries to make issue directives or national instructions relating to these courts. It really is not necessary to micro-legislate.
Maybe just on that last point, I do get what they're saying, because the current directives talk to issues that are broadly around the management of sexual offences, and in the directive I'm just specifically speaking for the NPA, are specific requirements that the NPA has to perform in terms of the directions in relation to specific sections. So, for example, we had to be directed specifically how we were going to deal with Section 15 and 16 cases. we have looked specifically at around when we use intermediaries, etc. So I think the argument from Shukumisa, without trying to put words in their mouth, is that if you have a change to the legislation with the advent of sexual offences court, there should be some obligation on the various departments to now look at the directives specifically in relation to the now phenomenon of sexual offences court. Mm-hmm. It was something that we debated when we actually did our submission, and we looked at it, and the reason we didn't put anything in is because we thought that maybe the regulations would cover that. But I'm not so sure the regulations will do that, and I think that the directors in the past have been quite pointed in terms of what the NPA is required to do. The sexual offences court, a directive relating to sexual offences court, probably wouldn't be that out of place. I can't speak for the other two departments. I'm not quite sure how relevant the other two departments are, because their role in relation to sexual offences courts per se is not direct or indirect. So the NPA may be the only government department that may require an amendment around the directors, our directors as well as the national instructions. I bet they're asking the question then.
But the National Commissioner must do it with you. So you do play a role there. Dr. Mishra.
Yes, I'm not sure who is so commissioned. Maybe there's different understandings for because when a minister is part of the prayer, and even the president operate take decisions in a very different way. And that's why I agree with that, the regulations will be binding
everywhere.
Certain certain of the criteria that are contained in the model of what a sexual offence is.
Maybe I need to be assisted. Would it make a difference to talk about guidelines as opposed to directives? Because guidelines would be assisting people to understand what must be done, rather than something that is saying you do it or nothing.
Let me see if you have an answer to that, other than in terms of the current framework, the way that the Act is currently framed, we have directives. As SAPs have national instructions, and I'm not sure if there is any legislative precedent for something like guidelines as opposed to directives. I'd have to ask you guys to respond to that.
Alright. So what the department has here, does that suffice? That's essentially the question we're asking of you and the MTA. Yes, Dr. Mishra. I'm sorry, I don't want you to call it Mishra. Because I'm just wondering, if we say directives, does that make it mandate? Just that guidelines would not be mandate. And that would be able to accommodate a situation where the circumstances don't permit something. Then you don't keep yourself in the corner and try to come out when you have sent yourself.
To bring in about sexual offences for the online, because it sounds to me like we're just creating an idea. I mean, we can sit for a long debate as to what's possible and what's not possible and where money is being spent, where it's being wasted, and all that other kind of thing. If the NPA wants an out, then just giving them an out. They must use the department and the NPA must, if we don't establish the court that's been accepted after a long time, that we are going to, then we must do it properly. We can't just have a wishy-washy, half-baked court with some facilities here and some facilities there, and then we spend money wasting it on other things and other things.
Could you tell us what kind of directives would you consider? What is the nature of the directive?
If you look at the other directives that we currently have, and keep looking for an example here. There's a lot of reference to criteria used in circumstances and manner under which we would make certain decisions and implement certain aspects of it. I mean, I agree that effectively, I suppose what I'm proposing is to bind the NPA closer to the implementation of sexual offences courts. And maybe that's not a realistic ethic that we need over and above regulation, because if the act or the bill becomes an act, there is an obligation on governments to implement sexual offence courts, and maybe we don't need anything more than that. Other than we have the regulations which are going to stipulate exactly what these courts look like and require, and there will be obligations there based on the NPA, and will be bound by those regulations. And maybe the current directives are broad enough, and then also specific enough, to ensure that within those sexual offence courts, all of those criteria are met as stipulated in the directives.
Are the directives done in terms of regulations, or are they totally different? So there's nothing really going to be governed in the regulations, what would be in the directives? Potentially the regulation would be more specific. See, the whole point of the object court is that they have to comply with certain criteria to be really acknowledged as professionally sexual offence court. So if they're not, then why would you?
Well, no. Can it be challenged? You're not lawyers. You're a lawyer yourself.
The point is, why would it be challenged? Okay, if the government is committed to implementing establishing the court, then they must make sure that they're not corrupt. Otherwise, they must do it.
In our society today, there's some fundamentalist tendencies. Fundamentalist tendencies, because as I said, we are a developing nation. We want to set the highest possible standards, and it's correct to do so. But we shouldn't, in trying to do so, create a situation that some of our laws will become unimplementable, and then we will spend every day in court, somebody challenging that we didn't meet that requirement, we didn't meet that requirement. And there are competing interests in society. There's poverty, unemployment, there are all these things. So I don't think that we should take absolute positions. And I don't think that there can be any minister or any government who can be serious in dealing with this problem of sexual offence. So I just want to appeal to the drafters that they really need to draft the law, not in absolutist or fundamentalist terms, which will make this thing unimplementable, and then we end up in court, and the country has to stand still.
In connection to the issue of directors, the directors are in place to look at how the NPA will implement the Act. So if part of the Act now has Section of the Census Board, surely there should be some requirement on the NPA to say how are you going to implement Section of the Census Board. It's the same as of them saying, you know, I mean, in the directors, there is a director around sentencing, and we, a requirement around sentencing. In the directors, we had to indicate what issues should be placed before the court in the sentencing of the sexual offences matter. So, the argument could go with, now you have sexual offences court, how is the NPA going to ensure that we implement sexual offences court from prosecuting perspective? And some of the things that we would potentially put in there is that we undertake to comply to the, it'll always be to the best of our ability and in the available resources, including to supply two prosecutors per court, to have trained personnel, to maintain skills development, all of those kind of things. But I don't think that I don't think it's an inappropriate place to place a duty on a government department to comply with that piece of legislation practically. Yes, in the directives. It would have to be in the directives.
I don't think anybody would have a problem with the how are you going to do it. These are the requirements. These are the requirements. But it shouldn't be in specific terms to say these are the requirements failing which you can implement the policy. So that's why I said we must leave this matter in a good hand to couch it in a way that it will not be. So I think we're this man is interesting again.
I was thinking that since in the original legislation, the partner departments are required to develop national instructions, directives, and so on. Couldn't we just have a clause that says they amend their directives to take into consideration the amendment bill, the implementation of the amendment bill, so that they can outline the manner in which the amendment bill will be implemented by their respective officials.
Thank you.
So I think it would be easy enough, I mean, to incorporate your sentiment. It's simply to add a directive saying that the NPA, we have to phrase is, I think that it would be Directive 10, although what else is coming out, but it actually would be Directive 9 again, that we need to develop, I don't know what the phrase would you just use, but in the manner in which the NPA would implement Section 10 supports. It would have to be something quite broad like that, and maybe, as been suggested, we could just look at the formulation thereof, that it isn't descriptive, that it's broad enough to, that the NPA would be able to just lift the implementation practice.
Yes.
Thank you.
that in the hands of the NPA. So then,
tell us why not.
Well, no, we have such housing directors and not directors, instructions and all together. I think we call the child justice act on this one. Not easy. But putting a bit of pressure to actually amend or potentiate your standard operating procedure is actually quite helpful.
Yeah, that's been our problems. That in good faith, in the past, we've done that. And then 5 years later, we ask, we do a review and realize, good grief, they haven't even done. And when you ask why, well, it takes a whole day to get an explanation.
Maybe it's true.
Transferring our responsibilities to make the law to someone or leave it in their hand and they don't do it. So, yeah, it's just that some of the stuff is in their hands. It does. We acknowledge that. No, and, yes.
So, what I'm saying is that I hear that you have a trustee, that you leave it in their hands. 5 years down the line, it's not done. And still suggesting that, you know, maybe some pressure must be put some mechanism to ensure that it's done. So, what are we
saying? Yes, good question. The original directors, the original act said the directors had to be submitted to Parliament by the NPA in X amount of time.
Yes.
So, the amendment would read that directors, now the new directors 10 or the new directors 9 would have to be submitted to Parliament within however many months of the passing of the legislation.
Yes.
And the director would say something along the lines of the manner in which the NPA will implement section or clause whatever or section whatever it is now in terms of the new amendment section into the legislation.
Okay.
So we're going to include
requirements that would be tabled in Parliament. Okay. Hello?
The original was.
What was the original?
That within a year after the next one, this act and every 12 months thereafter, have a report or whatever it is.
Alright, well, this year, in the annual report, we'll check it that time. As part of the annual report. Yes?
What are they going to do while they're acting in operation for 5 years?
Well, for this, we have to give another year. Yes, it was.
Wow.
How can you pass this law and then say, come, save it?
I don't know when the act starts, how they're going to implement it.
Sorry, I was reading from, not on the national instructions, I was reading from something else. This time we had 6 months.
Is it 6 months? Well, you've got 6 months.
6 months gone
already.
I don't know, they say it's on public
Okay.
Thank you.
So, well, that's then the, that's giving effect to the request of Chukwumisa campaign. So it'll be the tax negative. It's going to be a requirement for SATs to get the drafting clarity. It's going to be a requirement for SATs for the MPP and for BG Health. Chukwumisa campaign is also advocating that social development and provincial services must be obliged to issue directives in similar way. There isn't an obligation on social development and correctional services in terms of the legislation at the moment for that. No, they are also advocating that we call to get.
Okay. Alright, let me hear you. I saw Bronwyn nodding her head, but I'm not sure whether she was nodding her head to agree with Shumisa.
I'm not about agreeing with the Chief Minister per se, but I think if we look at the running of these schools, the ESD is an essential element to that. Specifically, if we are including as the committee has really members, around actually detailing, sorry, I'm going back to this, detailing as we did on page 17 and 18, exactly what the courts would, or what the regulations would look at, and it would be on support services for victims of sexual offences. Now those support services would have to be supplied by DSC and or NGOs who are supported financially by DSC. I think, again, I can't speak on what DSC, but I think they're an essential player to the implementation of these courts. And if they are, they need to come on board, and it needs to be some obligation placed on them around resourcing these courts for effective operation.
Okay, so it's just DSD.
Yeah. No, they're the ones that aren't, they're the ones who currently aren't in, and the DCS aren't in.
My suggestion is going to be that we also include DCS, because sexual offences counts, the principle of sexual offences counts is about focusing on the victim. So even after sentence and the serving of sentence, the victim should be paramount. And also to have, I think that they will have to also ensure that they contribute to prevention and the reduction of recidivism in these cases by providing certain programs.
Okay. I admire your ambition.
Okay.
All right. I don't see anything wrong with putting it there. But my sweet smarts tell me never going to happen. But anyway.
To my mind, these are meant to be dealing with the prosecution of the sexual offences more than afterwards. Not the DCS, but I mean, I do think DCS has a role anyway, ensuring things like that the accused serious forces of backcutting, you know, how are they going to deal with that? I don't know if that needs to be put in directly, because that's supposed to happen anyway. Yeah. I mean, but I don't think that the time things should be taken to prosecute. The purpose of this is to ensure the actual prosecution of the offences as it happens.
I think what Ms. Ambula is referring to is the fact that the accused, the sentenced, acknowledges, and that's where DCS comes in, these programs, where they acknowledge that, okay, I did wrong. A lot of the problem arises that when the sentenced prisoner leaves prison, he comes into society with enormous, well, not only no change, but believing that he has been wronged. Yes, well, you know, perhaps that's what Ms. Kambula is referring to, amongst other things. Bringing the prisoner to court for trial, I guess, that's, surely we don't need directors for that. No, I didn't think you did. Yeah.
I'd say I would endorse Ms. Kambula's view because it's in line with what we started in victimology, the sense of victim.
I think again we need to differentiate between the general management of sexual offences, which on no level is undermined that each department has a role to play.
Right.
But what we're specifically looking at now is the operation of sexual offences courts. So I'm not saying it isn't an obligation. In fact, the DDS has developed quite extensive, I don't know what they call them, the instructions or directives themselves around how to manage sexual offences victims with role here. And they have those in place, that's part of the policy.
Really?
So I'm not scared.
So how did Anthony Bobby get No, not the same way. No, not the same way.
No. So, you know, those are things I'm not saying that they're obviously very important, but they don't pertain to sexual offences courts, per se. And I think these directors must specifically focus on the operating of the courts.
Well, so what are we saying then? DCS not included? Social development included, not included?
Yes.
Social development definitely included. Alright. DCS? Not necessarily.
I think there's no harm in requesting the DCS to apply its mind in respect of their contribution in making the sexual offences code effective. The fact that they will be transporting the accused to court is part and parcel of, you know, making sure, we should make sure that they are efficient in establishing rules of how they manage and how they understand the rules of the game in the sexual offences court. So they need to insert themselves within that environment in order for us to be able to collectively reach the objective. If they say that, for instance, if they do not communicate efficiently with the court, the fact that a victim is in hospital, I mean an accused is in hospital, and therefore they will not be able to bring him in court in on a particular day, it still affects the victim, because the victim will be in court and the accused is not in court. So there's a general spirit in which all the role players should or ought to understand the operation of the sexual offences court. So it might not be central to the running or the operation of the court, but it would be central to the spirit of achieving the objective of the establishment of the sexual offences court, which is need reduce the case cycle time, also reduce victimization or secondary victimization of the victim.
I understand the point, but against my point is that the running of these courts is different to other courts in what way? And the issues that are being raised, which is getting accused to court, etc., apply to all matters. And the effective case management of all matters, whether they're sexual offenders, murder cases, fraud cases, etc. And it's the same with the point of police, because some of you are accused who are waiting trial are in the hands of the police in terms of transportation. It's actually not DCS that's bringing those people to court. So they will have to take the obligation of leave to do that. But they are under that obligation anyway, across the board. So my question would be, what is the relevance of a specific sexual offences matter? Or just know, because this is a sexual offences court. I don't see the relevance of it.
Social development we include. Let's leave it at that, please, Honourable Lord. Okay.
Well, that effectively takes us to the end of all the comments that were raised.
Uh-huh.
National Council of Women did draw our attention to quite a few articles in various reports and in the media. I think they're just there for noting.
Okay. All right. Like judicial matters, on our first day after the constituency period, is there any reason why we should formally consider this book? Well, yeah, well, the point is we can't indefinitely not agree to it. We can't just sit on it, you know, because at some point someone's going to say to me, look, what in heaven's name is going on? No. The question I pose is there any reason why we shouldn't approve the bill? Now, I did that this morning, and you gave me a very reasonable answer, and it applies to this one as well. So, good. Right. Now, it's 5 to 12. Ronald, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Ms. Kambula and everyone else for your inputs. Really appreciate it. That leaves us with the SA Human Rights Commission book. Lovelies. Thank you.
is it the one that on page 2?
Is it this one here?
On the last time, I know some these parts would be concerned about safety and provisions, even though they had been included in the act beforehand. You know, should they actually be here for the human rights commission?
Mm.
And I do think it is a bit of a source of concern. I mean, to what extent should they be allowed to go into public property and just take them? If they aren't a police body, it's not a crime that's being committed necessarily here, and if it is, then they should be referring to the police. And I think we need to maybe rethink this.
See, listen, I know that when the commission appeared before the committee, that safety issue was raised, and I think the chairperson then said that they have done it in one or two occasions. But it's merely I think he used the words, because I read the minutes of PMD, and I think he basically said that it's a threat to the court if they say that the legal court is going to come and seize your property, and then they sort of respond. But I do agree that maybe this is an important issue, so maybe the committee should give a bit more consideration to this issue. I will mark it, perhaps, and then I think, I don't know whether the committee wants to discuss whether the committee wants to discuss it today, or whether the committee wants to think about it, and then maybe at the next meeting. Come back with a certain proposals.
Well, I put straight to your 12:30.
let me
just remind you of something. You see, I clearly recall Mr. Swartz concern. It relates to punishment of children. Some religions, as you know, perhaps they promote the idea, and they find biblical reasons for it, scriptural and otherwise. Okay. There are certain religions and churches who have actually put together a manual on how this should be done and why it should be done. Mr. Swartz says, now, imagine a situation where the Human Rights Commission marches on this church and demands all the manuals in the possession of that particular church. In terms of effect that will have in a constitutional democracy. However you may feel about spanking and whatever the courts may have decided, but there is this view in certain religions that it's perfectly okay. In fact, they encourage it. So that's the concern now. We would need to, as Lopez is right, we need to discuss this. Back then, when you passed the Act of 1994, we were thinking in terms of the Commission approaching a department, not in terms of the Commission approaching the Church. be here? And if so, what requirements should we put in place? And that's a debate you're going to need to engage in.
I mean, can we not deliver the 12-year suggestion and could we flag this and discuss it when it's particularly here because it wasn't concerned. But I know this doesn't say government support, it says any
premises.
And I think maybe we need to look at an option where maybe we can find it to government or public.
Well, what Mr. Swart proposes was that the commission be made to do what everyone else does. Like the court, like the rent, and so on. You see, and that's why I think I'd like him to be. I don't want to speak for him because, you know, he's far more capable of expressing his concerns than I can on his behalf. Dr. Mitchell.
I just want to be
allowed to be out of order. Well, I need to hear you first.
No, you see, I see our state law advisors are of my age. And whether we are not missing an opportunity to say when they appear before, they must be accompanied by younger lawyers. Younger lawyers who could be understudying them as part of the transformation. Because tomorrow, I am them when we're not there, and there's no second generation of people who can take forward the one. Thank you. For that, you are good.
Look, honourable members, so what are you saying? We need to have this debate, but not today.
Obviously, Chair, but members must also just keep in mind that this provision does not only apply to state departments and churches, but to every company.
Well, that's the concern. That's the concern.
So, because you, and I know Mr. Swart mentioned the example of churches, but it applies to each and every private company.
Sure. And at some point, someone's going to ask the all-important question, but why should the commission be precluded from going to court and get the necessary
I raised last time the fact that I had asked when they were with us, the FHRC, whether they had ever used all these powers, whether they needed them, and if you recall, the chairperson was on us, said they did indeed need them. It's only because they were a threat that they could hold against recalcitrant departments.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to, I don't remember verbatim what he said, and it wasn't clear to me what I said last time, whether he was talking only of the subpoena power or of the additional, the search and seizure, the ones that we want to build up. Is it possible for us to ask them to give us a formal written position on the reasons why they need these powers? Enough to rely on my memory on that because I didn't take notes.
Oh, okay. We'll do that this month. Let me hear Dr. Mitchell first, Mr. Lucas.
I attended a forum of the Premier of Gauteng where they brought together religious leaders. And the concern raised there was that whatever we do, there is a reference to religious and church. And they say that the word church is not inclusive of all faith groups. And once you use church, other faith groups will feel it to meet them. And they even resolved in that meeting that they should, the word faith-based organization should be used because we are a multi-religious society. And for instance, some people, if you say religion, they even say that Shintoism of the Japanese African religion is not religion.
Oh,
yes, that is a going back to the 1961 with South Africa's Christian state. So I just wanted to suggest that you look at that matter because there's a debate out there.
We agree we will flag this for discussion by the
committee. Because I just want to get back to this much view. I also referred to the Minister of PNG, and it wasn't clear how the issue of Sentinel with his session season.
I
suspect there was a greenup, in which case the question is unanswered. And I think I answered quite clearly that they have not been used. And we need to testify ourselves whether they need the powers.
They're running the process.
Yeah.
So then we move on to the clause 18,
right?
Compensation for sickness, causes and damage. What we're proposing is to substitute the word with state funds with national revenue fund. I know the previous meeting the question was raised, but why should the state pay for compensation due to acts by the commission? Why shouldn't the commission pay itself? I've got some bit of research, and that the provision is for a similar reason. The provisions are contained in the Commission on Gender Equality Act,
mm-hmm.
as well as the Public Protector Act. So again, those acts were 1994 and 1996 respectively. So maybe the view at that stage was a bit different from what it is nowadays. Because I just want to review that, for example, the definition for the provision in the Public Protector Act. The Public Protector may come out with a specific or general approval to the Minister of Finance or any person authorized by the said Minister to so approve, order that the expenses or portion of expenses incurred by any person in the course of or in connection with an investigation by the Public Protector be paid on state funds. So that is a provision which already appears in different other pieces of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say that we cannot or we should not change the law, but at some other stage we will then have to be consistent, because I mean you can't have expenses for the same kind of instance, but in some instances the state pays and other the commission pays. So at some other stage, and I don't know how it's going to happen, but if the committee decides that we should move away from this provision, then I think in the long term some sort of consistency will have to be created as far, so that we then finally decide, okay, the same place or the institution, right?
Thank you very much to you for that, because I think it's very useful, and especially for citing the date, 1996. I have always felt that the reason why, I know you were part of the legislative process, but why power and access was into the UK. It's something to do with our whole mindset, what we have just come to, the TRC, we fit in the TRC Act 95, and in fact those parts are not appropriate for any of these bodies. And what you have just said is simply a further manifestation, if you like, of, I think, a frame of mind from a different era. It's clearly inappropriate. That outside of all appropriation processes, bodies like these can now suddenly go and get money from. So, yeah, it doesn't work that way. And so you clearly have simply substituted state funds with the National Revenue Fund. And it's simply not appropriate. As far as I'm concerned, we can take out 18.1 and 18.3 right now. It's simply not appropriate. And what you say, that's what you're right. We must then also, in due course, remove them from the Public Protector and the CGE Act. Stuff just doesn't work like that.
So
education.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be argued that I might be totally incorrect, that the state funds to it, or the expression state funds is broader than National Revenue Fund. I need such an argument can be made. I don't know. I wasn't part of drafting of this legislation, but I think it was eventually led to the Human Rights Commission and the public sector to get their funds from Poland.
From appropriation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and any
I mean, neither would I imagine that there's any appropriation. I mean, now we had to induct Central and Cedars, we broke a few things, so it was unforeseen. Now you must pay us some of the adjustments. I mean, I think the same with no thanks.
I don't know whether my state law closer, my colleague here at the end of the table, whether she has any views.
They should be held to the committee.
I just wanted to alert the committee to those issues. I don't think the department will have any view, although this issue has not been discussed with either department, but I just want to highlight the issue so that the committee can at least apply its mind. But I've read it with the first option that we should delete reference due to the National Revenue Fund, subject to your agreement, your position.
No, I think our instruction will be to leave one as the other. And I think really,
all right, let's think about it. I understand the big concerns because it's really get out of hand, and someone needs to think about that situation.
I mean, an institution comes to defend its own proposed budget, they should be doing to us, not Christian. Then we say, well, hang on, you know, there's only so much money in teaching for justice in this case. We can give you so and so, but you have to work within your appropriation. You can't count it on investigations and things like that. Especially, all the more because these are such and seizures, which I don't think they should have such power.
Yes, but it's difficult. It's always been difficult for the Commission to have a crystal ball and predict what investigations they got to face. It's always been difficult. They can't. If they get the budget today, 6 months hence, money kind of arises, and there you have it. They don't have the budget. It's always been the problem.
The department has exactly the same problem, but they still have to find work within the money they've been allocated. And it's not because of action on their part that have caused damage. Does that make sense?
As far as search and seizure, I understand that their people must take responsibility for the action, if necessary.
But then what are you going to say? That they can come to the Parliament and stop spending money because they would have taken now extra investigation so they can demand the money.
The National Assembly seem to be in terms of the Constitution 6151.
He's looking for clarity. As long as we understand, we are saying we should actually be more specific and say the National Assembly. When you say Parliament, you include it.
In terms of Section 42(1) of the Constitution, Parliament is provided, the Parliament consists of the ENA and the ECP. So the moment when we retain the word Parliament, it will then include the ECP. So, but as in terms of 181, it's clear that the Chatham Islands are accountable to the National Assembly.
Mm-hmm. All right.
As I mentioned, we propose the insertion of a new subsection 3 and 4, which provides that sub 3 commission may, in a manner deemed fit, make known to any person, organization, or institution any finding or point of view or recommendation which we have matter in which we have argued. And then I think this is important, and this was an issue that was raised by the commission in the presentation, which I sort of disagree with. It's stated that there's no obligation on institutions to respond or to report back to the commission, but I think this one, subsection 4, sort of covers that issue, provides that if the commission makes any final recommendation made by another to the organizational institution concerned, that organizational institution must, within 30 days after becoming aware of such finding, respond in writing to the commission, indicating the steps that it has taken to give effect to the finding. So I think this sub-clause sort of covers the concern that was raised by the Commission during its presentation.
Okay. I just have one problem with that, and you will point me in a little bit onto what the thing was they said. Let's never forget that the chapter 9s are not considered, their findings are not binding. And therefore, I wonder whether we shouldn't insert here around 956 or somewhere, the word whether. If the Commission makes any finding of or recommendation, blah, 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 that institution must within 30 days after becoming aware of such finding or recommendation, responded in writing to the Commission indicating whether it intends to give effect. Indicating the steps even necessarily.
Okay.
Indicating whether it intends to give effect to such a recommendation. If so, what steps it intends to take? But then should we also say if not, no, why not? We can't even say if not, why not? We can't say that. The recommendations are not like. What they can do is, if there's trouble, they have the right to, in their own hands, go forth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think the whole purpose of this clause is sort of monitoring. Otherwise, it will serve no purpose if the commission investigates some act, makes a finding, informs the, whether it's the department or company or institution, informs them that listen, we have investigated this matter, this is our finding, and then the department just say, okay, fine, we hear what you say and then you leave. So I think the whole purpose of this clause is to enable the commission to, or to give them, to some extent, a monitoring power.
We agree
with
it.
We agree, but we just need to make it clear that they are not bound.
Okay, just help with that formulation again, please, Ms.
Weather. And line 56.
Yes.
Where is that finding recommended? It's responded writing to the commission, indicating whether it intends to give effect such recommendations. I think
that's enough. Yes, my question is, what's going to happen if they say that we do not intend to take these steps?
Then the commission must decide what steps it plans to take.
That the higher power depends on their moral persuasion.
Yes.
We can have a good commission. What they say is different. But it's up to them to have that moral
persuasion. Yeah, I think I was also just having a difficulty that if we say the recommendations are not binding, but then you provide that 30 minutes or 30 days after becoming aware, we must respond to them and say, we're going to do something. But if I'm not bound in the first place, I can ignore that time frame. And if I ignore it and then we take action against you, what would be the basis of the action? Because I'm not bound to respond to anything as well. No, they're bound here within 30 days. Must within 30 days indicate whether they intend to take steps. No. It's a debate we had with Truly What I Said. It's a debate we should have in the Women's chapter.
Okay.
Well, we don't have to, but all right, fine. And essentially it began with the question is, your finding will not make it really binding. And she argued that, no, my findings are akin to those of the court of law. And we differed. We said, no, it can't be. How can they be? Well, courts are the final arbiters.
I'm going to be because if the findings are binding, they can actually do run up
and they go.
That
was the point you made. That was the point you made, you see.
Exactly the point. They're not binding.
So there are recommendations.
There are recommendations,
yes. Yes, but then we don't want departments simply then just, you know, taking the recommendation and throwing it in the bin. There has to be some kind of response. So we're saying in this clause, within 30 days, after receiving it, indicate whether they intend to take steps. Yeah.
Mr. Jensen, I would like to propose that we have to make that 30 days, maybe 60 days.
60
days? I agree with you.
Also, I mean, the recommendation of, and this is not the department's view, it's my personal view, the recommendation or finding of the commission is, for example, submitted to the office of the CEO, or
the head of the entity.
Yeah. And from there to go down all the line, the way down, for somebody to look at the finding, to prepare a response which must go back all the way for the CEO's signature. So I think 30 days is a bit short.
Right. I've been convinced 60 days. Yes, ma'am?
But the question says within 30 days of becoming aware. As soon as they become aware, that they can respond.
Yes, now Mr. Lascani is now proposing that because you've got this long
chain,
because it may occur at a little regional office, wherever, and your DG or your CEO then must be given an opportunity to put into effect the recommendation of the commission. All right?
Support that is 6 days.
No.
I think there's a complication. This might work out. The complication in a government department or at a corporation.
I'm just thinking why we're doing this. I need to go and look at Public Protector Act. We have a DG here. DG of Justice. There was a case where an official in a regional office was removed. In terms of all processes within the department, that official went to the public to complain. Public Protector investigated. When the DG became aware of it, that official had been reinstated without their knowledge. ask that question. I don't know whether this provision is found in the Public Protector Act, because to my mind it makes sense for the person at the head of the entity to at least be made aware that, listen, we've overturned your decision and we're going to put this person back in his office. That's just by the by.
Chairperson, personally, those kind of issues do not form part of my right function.
I hear what you're saying, but you can see why there's this concern.
That's right, but we also can consider, is that we study specifically that the findings must be made known to the head of the institution and not to a junior official.
Yeah,
which
is
that mistake
the Public Protector
Award.
I think that's right.
It makes absolute sense. Why do you simply want the head of an entity? I think it's wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. You know, and she has to work on budget. And the removal of this official meant that that official's budget, salary and benefits and so on, you know, there was adjustments had to be made. And the next thing she used 6 months later, hello, this Shekhar and then this Shekhar.
I don't know if I don't understand the theory. I thought that in every department there would be a person that is accountant. And now if decisions are going to be implemented without the knowledge of the accounting officer, that would create a problem. So I thought that it has to be logical that the head of the entity has to know that. I don't know if I...
Meeting is stopped.